Okay, welcome to people who have just arrived. So, got about 10 minutes before tea. So what I'm going to do is just kind of introduce the theme of the seminar, Beyond Ethics. So I'll probably do most of the talking before tea, but then after tea there'll be a chance for a bit more discussion between us all. So it's a 3-week seminar, so quite a short one this time, by me and Sila Priya, and it's called Beyond Ethics, rather intriguingly. So I thought before I say anything about ethics, I'll say something about this word beyond, and how to understand this word beyond and the way that we're using it when we say beyond ethics. So we can, if anybody's read Ratna Guna's book on reflection, which is quite a recent title that's come out, we've got it in the bookshop, he gives a nice little description of how you can understand the word beyond, and he says, well, you can understand it in two ways. So you can go beyond, obviously, in the sense of leaving something behind. But also, and this is the way we're more using it here when we're talking about beyond ethics, you're going beyond in the sense that you include more than that something. You're sort of going beyond it, but you're continuing to include it. So I'll just give you a little example that's the one Ratna Guna uses that makes sense of that. So he says, imagine you're out for a walk and you get lost. But you luckily bump into a farmer and you ask the farmer the way to the village. You're trying to get to a village. And the farmer says, go beyond that wood there and then you'll come to the village. So in that sense, he clearly means you leave the wood behind and then you come to the village. So that's obvious. But then, say you and the farmer get chatting to each other. And you ask the farmer, well, how far does your land extend? And the farmer says, oh, well, you see that road down there in the valley? He says, my land extends beyond that, as far as that tree line on the top of the next hill. So in that sense, obviously he's meaning that beyond means further than, but including the road in the valley. Do you see what I mean? So it's beyond in that sense. Is that clear? I can explain that well, yeah. So it's in this sense that I'm talking about beyond ethics. So we're not talking about beyond ethics in the sense of leaving ethics completely behind, but we're extending ourselves beyond ethics as we usually might think of the term ethics. That's the sense we're going to be exploring in the next few weeks. So here's a little statement I'm going to give you, and we can come back to this after tea and see what you think of it. So a Buddha or any person who has attained Bodhi or awakening, the word Buddha means awake, as we probably know. So any person who has attained Bodhi or awakening quite naturally responds to others with compassionate activity. Quite naturally cannot feel ill will towards anyone, regardless of what they do to him or to her. Quite naturally responds with metta, with loving kindness to all other beings. So these are the natural responses of someone who sees and knows things as they really are. It's quite natural. So now it refers to this diagram. I don't know if I've angled it right so everyone can see it. Can you see that? It's a very simple scheme. Some of you have seen that quite a number of times. We've been using this little model, you can hardly call it a diagram, very simple model, quite a lot this year. So what we've got, I'm trying to stand up. So what we've got is a sort of ascension, as it were, of what we're calling karma, niyama processes. Karma, of course, meaning action. Niyama meaning law, and then processes. And so we've got an ascension of that, as it were, and a descension of dharma niyama processes. So the karma niyama is what's the law that intentional actions have consequences. That's the law of karma. The dharma niyama processes, so these are, you could say, it's a bit harder to describe what that means, but you could say that the dharma niyama processes are the natural laws by which human beings can become Buddhas. The natural law by which awakening is possible. Yeah, so that's the dharma niyama processes. So this little scheme is simply a description of the way the bigger, more inclusive law of conditionality operates in different spheres of existence. So the karma niyama in the realms of ethics, and then the dharma niyama, that's the sort of purely spiritual realm, the realm, the laws by which human beings can become Buddhas. And it's as if we sort of ascend with this, we sort of ascend with our conduct, and it's as if at the same time this is coming down to meet us. I'm using as if because it's a model. It's not like there's literally something coming down upon us, and it's not like we're even literally rising up. But you've got, it's trying to show that there's a two-way thing happening. There's our effort, but then there's something beyond willed effort. That's the important point. So we'll be exploring that more. And as I say, we'll come back to after tea if there's questions. But from now, I'll just say that if you want to see a tangible experience of these dharma niyama processes at work, all you need to do is look at the life of the Buddha. So if you were to read any story of the life of the Buddha, particularly stories to do with the Buddha's interaction with other people, you'd see these dharma niyama processes at work, because what you would see is, just as in that little passage I quoted before, that whoever the Buddha meets, whatever the circumstances, the Buddha or any enlightened being always responds with wisdom and compassion. The Buddha or any enlightened being cannot but respond in that way. They can only respond in that way. So it's like that would be how you would how you'd see it in action, how you'd see these dharma niyama processes working. And you could say that the any genuinely spiritual life is, what we're doing in any genuine spiritual life is we're trying to make a transition from these karma niyama processes to dharma niyama processes. You can say that's a definition of what spiritual means, that we want to transition from one to the other. And if we to do that, the one way of doing that, or actually not even one way of doing it, for that to happen, what you need is an intense desire that your practice, that our practice, would be for the benefit of all, that it wouldn't just be for yourself. Or put it the other way around, that liberation from suffering can't be achieved without eradication of craving, without eradication of wanting everything for yourself, without eradication of selfishness. So liberation from suffering can't be achieved without eradication of selfishness. Craving, it can only be eradicated with the practice of generosity. It can't be eradicated without the practice of generosity. So maybe I'll leave it there. Maybe we'll have tea and then we'll come back. I'll see if there's So there's sort of pops and things out there. Some of this will be familiar to some of you. Some of it will be new. And even if it is familiar, there's always deeper we can go with these. So we'll have tea and then we'll come back and there'll be a chance to discuss that a bit more fully. Okay, welcome back. So I realise I said quite a lot in a way before the tea break. In some ways we could probably spend the whole evening just talking about those ideas. So maybe I'll just go over a bit again and see if there was any questions. So is that all right? Yeah. Okay. So the first kind of thing of sort of significance, I think I was saying, was that a Buddha or any person who has attained awakening, realised enlightenment, would quite naturally respond to others with compassion, would be unable to feel ill will towards anyone, regardless of, you know, what happens, what they do to him or her. They'd quite naturally respond with metta. So is there anything to say about that? Is that, like, can you imagine that, a state of where that would just be totally natural?
So, with the karma nima, if that's something that we're willful action,
yeah.
In the dharma nima, you're contrasting that as to something which is almost seems to be saying it's working through you.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. That's what it would feel. And again, I always say as if, so that we make... What we're trying to do all the time is not take that literally, that there is something that's working through us, but that's what it would... The experience would feel like that. That it would be less and less bound up with a sense of I. So, in this diagram, you've got... down here you've got quite a strong sense of I, so you're thinking, I have to make effort to be kind, I have to make effort not to get irritable, etc. But as you move up, where this solid line becomes a dotted line, and I've done this wiggly green line across, what I've written here is skillful action doesn't stop, it's just not willed. And that's because the sense of I as an agent isn't so fixed. You're starting to not refer everything to a sense of I. You're starting to more and more see that it's much more, things are much more fluid and interconnected than you previously imagined. Does that make sense, at least intellectually? I mean, it's quite hard to talk about these things because we might only have had a glimpse of... We might have had a glimpse of it, but probably most of us haven't had a sustained experience of that. But we may have had a glimpse of it. Or maybe that's a question to ask. Have people had a glimpse? Can people relate to a sort of glimpse of action that doesn't seem to be so driven by a sense of I? Yeah? Would anybody like to share an example that might illustrate it? Or share the kind of thing?
I started reading about Buddhism a while ago, and I haven't read very much, and I'm not very good at meditating yet, yeah. But just the part that I read about being aware of the sense of self and not relying on that so much, and trying to lose the ego. It helps me in some situations at work. You know, usually where I become quite defensive and quite protective over, you know, if someone was to criticise the way I work, usually I'd be quite defensive or critical or defensive or worried. But then to look at it from a larger picture and look at all the different roles that people play,
Well, that would be a way of seeing it, that you've got a bigger perspective, yeah? And to a Buddha, that would come quite naturally. So at the moment, like you, and same for me, you know, there's got to be a thinking process, and you reflect on that, and then that helps you. And then, so all this is saying really is, by the time you're a Buddha, you wouldn't even need to stop and think, it would just be quite natural. You'd have that perspective, that would just be your way of being. Yeah? Yes.
It's a silly thing, I suppose, quite small, in fact.
Yeah.
Quite regularly, I see people, one person taking a photograph of another person. Uh-huh. I go up to them and say, would you like your photographs taken together?
Yeah.
Just do it automatically. I feel that you know, there's two people there.
Yeah.
And do it just in this country as well.
Yeah.
I've done it in the orangery in Paris.
Yeah, well again, and that's a way, I think that's the movement from sort of self-centeredness towards just generosity, isn't it? Well,
it's just automatic, you see people who are together, there's a part in themselves, basically, individual photographs.
Yeah.
You can tell if they're from abroad, probably, and so you go to them and say, you like your photographs taken together, and generally speaking, they're over the moon to get their photographs taken with each other, rather than separately.
Yeah. Well, one way, and also a little to that question, are we just waving?
What I find difficult sometimes is losing my sense of self.
Uh-huh.
So, I'm not sure if this is what you're talking about, but I have a very fixed idea of who I am and what kind of person I am, what things I like, don't like, what I do, what I want to do. And the idea of losing that sense of self, or losing that, all of that. Although it feels a bit liberating, it also leaves me with a big question mark as to what I am and how should I conduct myself anyway. So it's kind of, what am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
I'm not supposed to.
Well, that's a good question. And I think we've got to not be too... I'm glad you said that. So I think we've got to watch for these terms like losing a sense of self or losing our ego or so on. Because I think that makes it sound like, you know, what's going to be left, So I think I prefer the language of... we're moving from selfishness to generosity, for example, of seeing that, of having a bigger perspective. So it's not so much a sense of loss, it's a sense of actually you're realising there's more than a sort of the sort of narrow viewpoint that we're often preoccupied with. You're opening up to see that there's a much bigger perspective. I think personally I find that more helpful. Because otherwise we can think it's about negating ourselves, which it isn't. It's more, I mean, I think in a way just even that simple word, like moving from selfishness to generosity, does quite well. And what we're trying to do is seeing that, it's starting to see that we'll have the perspective that all other beings, like their wants and desires, I'll just backtrack a little bit. One of my favourite ways of understanding this was Sangharaj just said, given this example before, he says, if someone you really love asks you to do something and you do it, whose will is it? So in one way, it's not totally your own will because they've asked you to do it, but it's not totally their will because you've willingly done it. And we've all had that experience, I'm sure, haven't we? With somebody we really love, you're only too happy to help them. So it's like it's a kind of merging of wills on a higher level, but it's willingly done by you and it's asked by them. And so if you could imagine just expanding that to all beings, that would be the state of a Buddha, because the Buddha would love every being. So the Buddha, you know, so I think that gives more of a sense of fullness. Does that help? Yeah. Okay, well, I'll take two more, and then what I'll do is I'll try and move on, because we wanted... So, Nico,
The way you described the Buddha then... as being incapable of feeling ill will...
Yeah.
...makes him feel very remote to me.
Right,
and,
yeah.
...makes him feel quite alien and non-human, in a sense, and... almost does feel a bit too impossible...
To our experience, and that's the. It's interesting because I think that's the. It's interesting with ideals, isn't it? There's a tension between when is the ideal inspiring and when is I actually think, oh God, that's just so remote, I might as well not even bother starting. So I wonder if it helps to... Well, what might help is to... Two things. One is just think of a person who you might... One might look up to a bit, who seems to be a bit more positive than oneself. And maybe somebody who seems to be able to respond creatively to even difficult situations. I mean, again, we can probably all think of somebody like that. And then think in our own experience. You know, I think we all have times or periods. For me, it's often when I've just been on retreat, when I see I'm more kind of creative in the world. Like, things don't throw me so much. You know, even if somebody's rude to me or something goes wrong, I seem to find an appropriate response. Other times it's the opposite, of course, isn't it? I mean, can you think of those kind of times in your experience where you felt a bit more... So then I would say just kind of think of that, but just imagine if you were like that a bit more of the time. And then imagine if you were like it, you know. So I think we can take it step by step. Because I think it is, well, in a minute we're going to be talking a bit about why Buddhism says it is important to have a goal, but also we mustn't, yeah, if that goal serves to just discourage us from even starting, then we'll have to find some way of being drawn on, but in a realistic way. And in a way, what you said about the Buddha not even seeming human is, in a sense, true. The Buddha, as we all know, was born as a human being, but by realising this state of non-hatred, non-greed and non-delusion, he did in fact go beyond what we would normally call human. So in a sense he became a new category of being, because usually humanity is defined by, you know, we're driven by greed, hatred and delusion. So that can make it feel a bit remote, but hopefully by thinking of it in those smaller ways we can connect with it as a positive thing. Yeah. Were you going to say something, Sam?
It might just lead on from that. I was just thinking about in my experience, if I ever touched on that, and I was thinking maybe over the last week, sometimes when you're thrown into something, you haven't got a chance to maybe prejudge it and you automatically respond with what's kind of needed.
Yeah.
Sometimes when you don't have kind of time
to
there was three kids at the top of a very, very steep slide recently, one of my own child and two others, and they were all really desperate to go down, but they needed a hand, you know, and there was a lot of activity going on, so just kind of helping, but there was a lot happening, and it was all spur of the moment, and afterwards, like, the mother said, oh, you've done that really well, but I didn't feel like I'd take any credit for it, because I hadn't tried to do anything in particular, you know.
Yes.
So that's the closest I feel, like, you know, with something you just acting without, you know, trying to take some credit or...
Yeah, and that's what it's... And again, it's like, it's quite good to just notice those experiences, even though they seem small, and just, it's almost like imagine, that's the sort of flavour of it. It's just spontaneous. It's not with a sense of, here is me doing this good thing, and, you know, it's just spontaneous, and that's what an enlightened being... But just be spontaneous, you know. And we better move on a little bit, but thank you for all those. So, you could say that's what we're, those some of us, and maybe even all of us, have had glimpses of what that spontaneous positive activity would be. And it would be in relation to other beings. And that would mark that transition. That would mark that transition from kind of, in a sense, just being a good person and doing good in the world to something that's got a bit of a higher dimension to it. That's what we mean. We talk about that transition from karma niyama processes to dharma niyama processes. So I'm going to just go on to the next bit. So Buddhism, you might, some of you have heard this, and you can give the answers if you have, talks about three root poisons. So it talks about three root poisons which are common to all human beings. So who can just remind us what they are, the three root poisons?
Greed.
Greed, yeah.
Hatred.
Hatred, yeah.
Delusion.
Delusion, yeah. Greed, hatred, and delusion. So they're the three root poisons, and they're sometimes shown figuratively in a picture called the Wheel of Life. And can anyone remember, in this picture, it's a Tibetan symbol, can anybody remember what animals they are? They're each shown as an animal which drives the hub of the Wheel of Life.
Is it one animal or two?
There's three actually, there's an animal three. For each.
Is it snake?
Snake, yeah.
Snake.
Pig, snake, and cock, yeah. Yeah, no rat, although, yeah, you'd always think they would be a rat. So the three root poisons, I think I might have written that up as well. Let me just talk a bit about it. Greed, hatred, and delusion. Oh, yeah, there you go, three poisons. And these are the Sanskrit words. Actually, maybe, Silipu, would you write up the cock, snake, and pig? So, lobha is greed, dvesa is hatred, and moha is pig. And in the, it's quite a graphic image, because what you've got is you've got this wheel, which is the wheel representing our existence, and these animals are biting each other's tails to sort of show that they're all feeding off each other. And they're driving us. That's how, in a sense, that's how we become, that's how we create and recreate ourselves. And when I said a minute ago that the Buddha has sort of become a new species of being, as it were, he's gone beyond what we normally think of as human, it's because he's completely taken himself outside that realm of being driven by these three. And if we want to, even though it may seem an impossible ideal, if we want to move in that direction, this is the area that we're going to have to tackle. Yeah. So we have to try and transform greed, hatred, and delusion. And there's a little formula for this, and it's called the mind precepts, and it's the precepts that in our order, as order members, we take on as vows. We take on 10 precepts, and these are the mind precepts or vows. So we say, abandoning covetousness for tranquility, I purify my mind. So that's the one that relates to greed or covetousness. Changing hatred into compassion, I purify my mind. Transforming ignorance into wisdom, I purify my mind. And, well, as I say, we, as those of us who are ordained, we've taken these as vows at our ordination, but you don't have to wait till you get ordained to practice them, because these are the root things that we want to tackle if we want to experience that state of freedom, of enlightenment. And what Sangharakshita says, he says that these precepts, which are part of the set of 10, the other precepts are to do with actions of body and speech, and some of you will be familiar with them, like practicing non-violence, practicing not taking the not given, practicing not speaking with false speech, and so on. But Sangharakshita says these three precepts, these in particular, he says they aren't just precepts in the ethical sense like the others. They've got a transcendental significance. And because they're orientated in the direction of wisdom. So their significance goes far beyond the social and cultural level represented by the precepts to do with body and speech. Because you could practice the precepts of body and speech. Well, you could practice them on greater or lesser levels in a way. You could practice them on a cultural or social level, couldn't you? You could, in a way, they do make the world go better if people do practice them. But that's the same. There's even beyond that. Good though that is, you can take it much further than that. So Tsangaraj says, to go for refuge effectively, or to practice Buddhism effectively, you must, in a way, you've got to set your sights high. Yeah? He says you've got to intend consciously and deliberately to aim for the transcendental, or to something that goes beyond our mundane existence. He says it's not enough to purify your actions, it's not enough to purify your speech. You've got to purify your mind, because only by doing so can you realise enlightenment. In other words, enter the stream of this Dharma Niyama process that I was showing. Would you ever be able to experience that? Any thoughts about that? The time is zooming on at a tremendous rate, but... I'll take Ben first. Maybe people can put their hands up for this
picture. Sorry, which animal? So would the pig represent greed? Because I would say greed.
Yes, it usually does, but it's actually ignorance in this scheme.
The pig is ignorance.
Yeah.
The cock and the snake.
The cock is greed, and then the snake's hatred. Yeah. Yeah. What were you going to say?
It makes sense in the sense that talking about working on the mind is kind of working at the kind of root causes.
Yeah.
Because if you're...
Yeah.
It's good to recognise that your behaviour might sometimes be unkind.
Yeah.
And to attempt to be more kind. Yeah. But unless you're actually... Well, the way to actually move forward is to work with the kind of root causes of that.
You're saying
about actually purifying the mind.
Yeah,
kind of going to the root causes.
Yeah.
And then the positive behaviour starts more spontaneously.
Yes, and interesting enough, it will happen the other way around. If we work on our actions with that in mind, that we're trying to transform our consciousness, it'll have an effect that way around.
Yes.
But it's with having that vision, because you could just work on your actions. You know, you could think, well, I'll be nice to other people, so they'll be nice to me, and then that'll be good because we live in a more positive world. But Sangharaj said, there's an even greater reason to work on your actions than that, which is going to that root cause. So it's reciprocal. By working on our actions, we'll affect our mind, and by working on our mind, we'll affect our actions. Yeah. So, and that's interesting because it might look the same from the outside. That kind of sense, nobody could tell apart from yourself why you were doing it. So two actions could look the same. But there could be different motivations behind it. And it's the motivation behind it if the motivation is for liberation for oneself and all beings, that's a particular motivation as compared to something more social or more legal or something, but it could be the same, you know, it could look the same. Do you see what I mean? Yeah. So it's only going to be an inner thing, really, that you know yourself. It's going to be an inner motivation.
Can I ask how you were using the word transcendent?
That is a very good question. Let me just think about that. So, well, one way of putting it would be that it's the realm beyond. It's seeing that there is a reality beyond self-centeredness. That there is something beyond that. So you're transcending your usual sense of self. You're transcending that greed, hatred and delusion that's driving us and defining us.
It's difficult because, like you said earlier about I'm not slipping into ideas of losing, in some sense, like losing ego or things like that. Sometimes that word transcend does the same thing for me. It's like,
well,
you know, we need to get over ourselves to be ourselves. But then that's to kind of almost put a bad label on ourselves, because that we then need to, it's like saying we're bad. It's not saying that at all, but it's got that slight concept.
Okay, let me try and think of another way of putting it. Yeah, because that's definitely not saying that. Maybe it's a bit like that thing in the farmer and the beyond the village, you know. We're including ourselves, it's still including ourselves, but it's going to, there's a bigger perspective. And so we're definitely moving towards an experience of more fullness and richness. That's why I find it quite helpful to think of those examples, like wanting to help someone you love, because when you, the experience of that isn't of oneself being diminished, usually, is it? It's of oneself being enhanced. There's more of oneself. Yeah. So it's not so much this, and it's not, Buddhism says that it isn't the ego, it's not that we've got an ego and we've got to be rid of it. It's more that we see through the fact that we ever thought we were separate from other people in the first place. We think we're separate from other people, and then that's the root delusion, so we've got to protect ourselves. But actually, we realise, and that's why on enlightenment people sometimes are said to just burst out laughing, you realise you were never actually separate in the first place. So you put all this effort into defending something that actually didn't need defended, because, I know what it's like. It's like, I've got a good example. My friend was out doing some wild camping, and the first night she got into her tent, she was in the Spanish mountains, and she said she was really, really scared. She heard all these noises, and she thought there's all these beasties and animals and everything like that, and she felt really afraid. And she came up with a radical solution. The next night she decided just to take the tent away and just sleep in the open. And she said she wasn't scared. And then she said, so there was no outside. So there was nothing to be frightened of. So that's what it's like. You suddenly realise, God, there was no outside. So there's nothing to be scared of. So she wasn't scared. She said, it was just her and the... It was much more experience of... It was just her and the beasties and animals, but they were all just... So I really liked that. So it's like you realise, there's no outside. We put this wall like the tent, going, here's me, and outside is either a threat that you've got to keep out, or something you think will enhance you, so you've got to bring in, but actually you burst out laughing because you realise that's all an illusion. So I don't know, does that help? Okay, so I've said enough about this diagram. I haven't even got to the main subject of tonight yet. This was meant to be the introduction. I think all I was going to say, but I think I've already said it, is for sort of morality or ethics as we practice it, being unenlightened, we only need to make a constant and deliberate effort. We practice the precepts, as Buddhists and so on, but transcendent morality of a Buddha who's sort of taken that tent off and realises there is no outside, needs no effort at all for its maintenance. It just will continually unfold. And I'm always pointing this out, but on this diagram, like, this is open-ended. So in a way we might experience it as sort of descending, but it's also, it's open-ended coming up like this. So even for a Buddha, this, the expressions of the Buddha's kindness and wisdom and compassion are just infinitely responsive. There's no end to it, of an infinite number of enlightened being would never come to the end of how they could express that. It would always be expressing itself differently because it would always be different circumstances. Okay, so now we're going to talk about the particular. So we're going to take each of these, greed, hatred, and delusion, a night each. So this week it is, we're going to talk about greed a bit more. Oh yeah, okay, so here we are. So, alopa means non-craving or non-greed. So that's what, so we're going to be exploring both non-craving and, in a way we're going to be exploring non-craving, but we're going to be exploring it by defining a bit more what craving is. So alopa, again, that's the Sanskrit word. So the prefix, whenever you see a prefix a, it means a negation. So that's quite an interesting grammatical form, isn't it? It's saying non-greed or non-craving. So why, you know, just want to spend a minute just trying to say why this grammatical form. Because I think it's important to realise it's not just a negation. They are positive states in their own right. It's the same with, similar in the word for hatred and non-hatred. And it's often said it's a bit like, there's a few words in English that are like this, like immortal is quite a classic one. Like when we use the word immortal, actually that's something very positive. It doesn't just mean not mortal. Or another one's invaluable or priceless. You know, sometimes we, you know, the word priceless doesn't just mean hasn't got a price, does it? It means something very, very, very valuable indeed. So it's a definite positive state in its own right, this word, aloba, non-craving. And it's a definite counter to craving. So basically non-craving drives out craving. And it's like an image that's given sometimes, it's like if you've got pegs, you know, like those children's games, you need a round peg to knock out another round peg. So one peg will knock out another. They can't coexist together, craving and non-craving. If you've got non-craving, you can't have craving. So we'll spend a little time looking at the opposite of non-craving. We'll look at craving, and there's a few words for this that are quite synonymous. So you've got the word raga, which means passionate attachment. You've got lobha, as we said, which means craving. You've got trishna, which means thirst. And then you've got kama, which means sensuous, sort of grasping for sensuous experience. So they all kind of are getting at this root tendency to grasp onto our experience. Sometimes in some traditions, instead of talking about subject and object, they talk about, in some Buddhist traditions, grasper and grasped. So we are the grasper, and there is the object becomes the grasped. So... Oh, I've taken, by the way, quite a lot of what I'm going to say in this next little bit from a lecture by Subhuti, who's coming along next week. If you want to listen to it, it's a whole series called Mind and Mental Events. They're on Free Buddhist Audio, and they were given in 2001. So there's a series of about 10 talks. I think they're really great. So this is talk 7, I think. So... And what Subhuti says, he says, well, what does this boil down to, this root tendency to grasp? So I think this is quite interesting. He says it's the taking of an object, and that object could be a mental object, and it's exaggerating its pleasurable aspects and minimising the painful aspects. So can you think of sort of examples of the kind of thing we might do that with?
New relationship.
Uh-huh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Say a bit more if you mind. Yeah. So, but what do we think?
When you're in love, you see all the
yeah.
the good
all the benefits to you and to the world in general.
Yeah.
And you might not pay so much attention to problems.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I think we do that in two ways, don't we? We do it with the person themselves, we exaggerate their qualities and sort of play down their faults, but also we kind of do it with that feeling of being in love, don't we? When we're in love, we think, oh yeah, being in love's great, and we're in touch with all the positive things, but forget about things like jealousy and, you know, all the flip side of it, don't we, that often goes along with that. So I think that's quite a good example. Any more?
Success. Materialism.
Yeah.
That can be a thirst and a strong motivation.
And
it can become an obsession as well.
Yeah. So again, just see that as an example of you exaggerate the positive at the and not see the downside.
Yeah, it's I guess you could obsess with the end result and delude yourself all the benefits that it will bring.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's obviously
So it's taken, again, it's a sort of distorting thing when we do that. I mean, other typical examples, it's often those things like alcohol, you know, you know, at the time, you know, when you might get a bit drunk or whatever. So you at the time, you're in touch with the pleasure, but you're not thinking, oh, I'm going to get a hangover, I'm going to do something I'll regret, and so on. So it's that kind of thing. And I think intoxication is quite a good example, because that's exactly what it's like. It might not be literal intoxication with alcohol, but it is like a state of intoxication when we're any of these things. Like being in love is like a state of intoxication, isn't it? So what's the Buddha saying is you blow out of proportion, you blow the positive out of proportion, and you diminish the downsides, you sort of forget the downsides, so you sort of distort. You're distorting the thing. He says it's you consider that by having that object, you'll enhance your own ego identity. So that's what's leading you to do it. You're looking for something outside of yourself to make yourself feel happy, and to make yourself feel more solid and secure. So he says that's what's really involved in the act of craving. And then doing that, and that's why we do this distortion thing. He says you identify that object as capable of enhancing your ego identity. Fundamentally, it's a move to secure your identity. Does that ring true? I mean, you can disagree if you like, but...
Also, if there's the element of distraction, you know, with obsession or addiction. So I find, especially in meditation, you know, for many years people might avoid just sitting with themselves and feeling pain or feeling any sort of emotions. So, you know, apart from the head center and ego, I wonder if distraction would come into that.
Well, it would be. I suppose distractions can be of different kinds, can't they? I think like we can often be distracted in that kind of craving way, can't we? That we want. Sometimes we get distracted in a more hatred way, don't we? Like we go over old quarrels and so on. But sometimes, yeah, we can think, you know, we can fantasize or whatever. And I think you're right. It's as long as we're doing that, we're not being in our present experience.
It's really difficult with the falling in love experience because that's not a bad thing, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
It's not really, you know, to feel intoxicated and by love and to let yourself go. That's what you're suggesting is we should be more reasoned and sensible and rational in that state of love. But by definition, isn't love about, you know, not necessarily being so kind of control.
Right. So you're worried that you'll be narrowing one sphere down.
Yeah, you narrow your experience in the
bathroom. Yeah. Well, that's an interesting point. So is that the only two options? So you've got one option which is being intoxicated, and then you've got another option which has been narrowed down, which doesn't sound very attractive, does it? Are there any more options? Do you think that are the only two options?
My experience.
Yeah. What would another option be? Even if I'm experienced it, can we imagine it? What would another option be?
Calmness about it, I think, definitely.
But does that sound a bit boring?
I don't know. I suppose other forms of, I don't know. Well, it's just steady and where you have a clear idea. You can see the pros and the cons, and you have a sense that you can see the reality of the situation, and yet your love is still unwavering. I guess that's a more a healthier way to love.
Okay, so why is it healthier?
Because the extremes are just too exhausting.
Okay.
And they're not really sustainable either.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So that's interesting. The extremes are exhausting and they're not sustainable. And what about
and they're based on a false premise.
Okay, so what's a false premise?
That you've either got an exaggerated idea of how amazing a person is or how awful they are.
Uh-huh.
Or
swinging from one to the other, and that's interesting, isn't it? Because I was going to just venture to ask about the other person and all this. Yeah. So if one's intoxicated in relation to another person, what effect is that? What do you think is the consequence on them?
I imagine it's not a very nice experience. I don't know.
Anybody else want to chip in?
In a way, you don't care because you just want to keep that intoxication going, and you'll do because you want it to be a permanent state, really.
Oh. So that's interesting. I mean, in a way, that's quite graphic what you're saying, but I think that intoxication can be more concerned about ourselves, can't it? We're not quite seeing the other person. But that's not to say we've got to be all, you know, and I'm really not saying we've got to be all, well, you know, I am going to be, you know, controlled and not let myself get carried away. It's like seeing, can we find a way to be joyful? Unhappy and experience pleasure, but without it being distorted, and I think not because anything's bad, you know. I think that's, and I've said this before here, that's one thing I really keep reminding myself about the Dharma. The Dharma's not saying we're bad if we do this or something. It's saying actually it will. Why it's trying to guide us away from this is it will cause our own suffering. You know, so it's starting to see that if we get intoxicated, say to the extent that we not even seeing the other person, well, certainly cause their suffering, you know. And I mean, that's quite extreme when we do that, but I think, I'm glad you said that, Sam, because I think we can get carried away to that, but we'll cause our own suffering because it's not sustainable. There'll be a big crash one day. And that's why we're trying to see, it's like a genuine middle way between the intoxication and being this kind of rigid control person, you know, which also the Dharma's not telling us to be. Well, that, you know, the Buddha being just spontaneously responding. So I'll say a little bit more about what the Buddha says, because I think that might kind of even draw that out a bit more. So Subhuti says, so yeah, I was just saying, he says, so it's a move to secure your own identity. And here's what he says, we turn the object into a contaminated object that is also an unreal object. I mean, of course, it's not, the object isn't, it's still itself. But he says, yes, you've got this poor innocent object, which might be a person, but now it's like, it's contaminated by our cravings. It becomes in our own mind, I mean, it's not that we've literally done anything to it, probably, or we might have, I suppose, but it's like it's within our own mind it's contaminated, so it becomes not what it really is, but a distorted, unreal object. He says, what you're looking at is not the object itself, but a projection of your own mind. And the mind and the object have got all mixed up. You see the object of your craving with unwise attention, it's called. That's the kind of Buddhist word. Is that... It sounds a bit... It sounds a bit sobering, doesn't it?
I almost want you to answer how you don't do that.
Yeah, okay, well, no, we'll come on to that. Okay.
I don't
want to
know.
I'm sure Romeo and Juliet would have liked to know.
Yeah. And it's interesting we don't want to know, don't we? Because I think, again, it's sort of, I think it's very common to think there's just those two options. Either we're carried away, even though we know that, usually in some tears, or we fear that that will mean we're kind of very dull and we haven't got any emotions and we're just going round like this kind of robot person not responding. So I think it is important to see that there can be, like, if we think of what could it be like if we weren't projecting, if we were seeing that object or that person for what it was? I mean, is there anything positive to say for that? Or has anyone even had any experience of that being a positive experience?
Isn't it about layers that, that you might start off projecting like that, but that you, through commitment, it's like a process, it takes time to then see through your own projections to the real object, person, or object.
Well, it might do. I think it's not always automatic that it does, and I think sometimes if we're not mindful, it can with a bit of a shock, you know. And then I think that's why, you know, we're talking quite a lot about relationships with people that so-called love can turn into hatred very, very quickly because our projection's been shattered. Whereas what you're talking about would be some more genuine meta that would be sustainable. And so sometimes it can transform. Sometimes we can transform that more fizzy intoxication for a person, say, into something that's more meta.
Mm.
I think we definitely need the ingredient of awareness and consciousness about that to do that.
Yeah, I think it's possible.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's interesting, when I went to sit for it, I got really inspired by Jan of Archer doing his talks.
Yeah.
And that process of still wanting to keep that inspiration, but also see him as a human being, is kind of what I feel like I'm navigating.
Yeah.
I feel that that's possible to do.
Yeah. And it sounds like you've got a lot of awareness around that, you're actively trying to do that.
Yeah.
And what's the experience? Is that experience, does that feel diminishing or enriching?
No, it doesn't feel diminishing.
And so that's, I mean, I think that's good that you can see that it doesn't mean, oh no, I've got to let go of this lovely, you know, kind of having someone up there. And I think that's what the Buddha's trying to get at when he's saying, he's not saying don't experience the pleasure. But it's like not putting more onto the object or person than it can give you. And then paradoxically, you can enjoy it more because you're seeing it for what it is, not for your idea of it.
then get the clinging bit where you want it to stay that way as well.
Yeah.
So I just think about the whole thing of impermanence.
Yeah.
I think the whole falling in love thing is quite a cruel and difficult one, but there's that thing about you want it to be a certain way and then you want it to stay that way, like Sam was saying about you just want your state of intoxication.
Yeah.
And it's something about being able to say, oh yeah, it's going to be this way and then it's going to change into something else and that's okay.
So
impermanence is all part of it.
Yeah, it's having that fluidity. And then that's how we can, and if we learn to navigate our lives like that, then it's much more free, isn't it?
So people tell me.
Yeah. He's one of those things easy to say but hard to do, isn't it?
Strongman says that falling in love, he calls it a process of crystallization. He talks about when you throw a branch into the mines in Austria, it gets covered in salt crystals so that it looks incredibly beautiful. And develops, and finally, it doesn't resemble the original branch at all, but it's like a scintillating, gleaming sort of branch chandelier thing. And that's the object, that's the, you know, the woman you're in love with, she becomes this glittering. You know, so perhaps the answer could be to enjoy all the crystals, and but also to see the original branch at the same time.
That's quite a nice image, isn't it?
Don't throw it down the mine.
What did you say, Sam? So it sounds like we've kind of, I think it's interesting we've gone on to falling in love and relationships, because I think that often is the strongest craving we experience. But what else do we? What else might we crave?
Reputation.
Okay, interesting. So, want to say any more about it?
Not really. Well, I mean, I think especially in this day and age, everybody's really obsessed with reputation.
Oh, reputation. Oh, you said meditation, actually.
No.
But
I can understand that one as well.
Yeah, but reputation, yeah.
Reputation.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's quite an so it's like your status in society,
yeah. Yeah, I think people believe that, you know, they're not their true selves until they've reached their full potential.
And
I think that can be quite disappointing because they never actually get there.
Okay.
You know, because it's a fantasy, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, then also with reputation, it sounds like quite caught with what other people think, doesn't it? You want other people to think well of you. And I think that, by its nature, is going to cause suffering, isn't it? By its very nature, it's got a sense of not being free in it. You're not being free to be that spontaneous quality we're talking about with the Buddha, because you're all the time wondering how you're seen in the eyes of society, your friends, or so on.
Very confining.
Yeah, it's very confining, isn't it? Yeah. Yes. So.
I wonder if we crave enlightenment.
Well, then that's interesting, isn't it? Because then that brings in a whole notion of, you see, there's two ways to look at this. So some, there's a kind of, there's, we can turn our spiritual life, if we turn our spiritual life into something that even subtly is trying to bolster up our sense of self, then we've kind of misused our spiritual life in a way. That's when we, I keep turning the page, if we do that, well, it's stuck underneath here, yeah? If we try and use it for our own gain, even in a subtle way, and that's why the best antidote to it is generosity, because that immediately gets us out of thinking of ourselves and think, well, how can I help other people? So that's one way. But to aspire for enlightenment it's like we've taken that craving for objects and we can transform it into something positive. Because the only reason that Buddhism says craving for objects or people or stuff like that isn't a good idea is because it doesn't work. because they do, because of impermanence, because the thing we're craving for, even if it does give us temporary satisfaction, can't last, and because while we're doing that, we're cultivating that unwise attention, we're getting ourselves into a not positive state of mind. But actually, Buddhism says the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, they aren't subject to the laws of impermanence. The Dharma will always be true, the Buddha is always enlightened, the Sangha is the community of individuals who are enlightened, always will be. So actually, we can give all our aspiration free rein. So it's not that the desire itself is wrong, as it were. It's that we make a mistake on what we put as the object of our desire. So I think that's quite important to remember, that we do have aspiration. It's just, you could say you're turning it from the sort of jargon term would be, you're turning it from false refuges to true refuges. But it's not just simply a matter of turning your head from there to there, because the nature of the desire will change. It will be much more, if we turn it to the true refuges, it will be much more fluid and responsive and spontaneously unfolding as positivity. Whereas it tends to be, that's the other thing about being in love or craving for alcohol or so on, we get very narrow, don't we? I remember once when I used to smoke cigarettes, I'd be maybe having a conversation with somebody, but in the back of my mind I was thinking, oh, I need to nip out and have a cigarette in a minute. So they weren't getting my full attention, you know, and I think, you see that if you're any sort of addictions like that, isn't it? You can't give the person your full attention because your mind's kind of taken by that. So it's the nature of the desire will change as well as the object of it. Well, look, we've got 5 minutes to go. This often happens. So we can crave for other people, we can crave for material objects and things, we can crave for things like status and reputation. Buddhism also talks about the craving for ideas and views and how that often our ideas, I think you were saying this as well, so that they can give us, well, that sense of security. We crave for the past, you know, we're often looking back and wishing that maybe we've done things differently in the past, and we can crave for things in the future. So this is what we do, and this is what we're trying to counteract, yeah? So this is what we try and counteract by, well, you know, there's different ways of counteracting. I think just sort of seeing through, I think reflecting on, trying to reflect with more wise attention can help us to counteract. And I think to reflect on the positive experience of when we have counteracted it a bit, like, you know, what you were saying about bringing a more wise attention to, yes, you still look up to Jnanavacha, but auntie's a human being, and actually that's enriching. So I think the more we can convince ourselves that that's an enriching thing, it'll be more attractive, because we're never going to, if we think, oh, it's going to mean we're this sort of dull kind of Ottoman sort of person, we're not going to be attracted to do it. So it's important to find within our experience when we have maybe done it even just a little bit, and see, well, did that lead to a more state of freedom, you know, a more state of dignity even, a more state of self-confidence, because it's like a true self-confidence. We're not relying on what other people say. It's the self-confidence of, we've taken that tent off, you know, we've got nothing to protect, nothing to hide. We don't mind what people know about us or think about us, because we actually know we're okay, actually. We're okay, we've got nothing to reproach ourselves for. It doesn't matter what people think of us. I mean, wouldn't that be amazing if we just didn't even mind what people thought of us, you know? We could just move through the world happy to be ourselves. That's what the Buddha would be like. Just happy to be himself, you know, of any enlightened being, happy to be him or herself. Not, you know, caring for people, but not caring what they thought, not caring about their reputation, not caring about their possession, you know, enjoying every person, not wanting that particular person or that, you know, just in every interaction would just be a pleasure. So in a way, that's another, I think, quite enriching way to look at it. Instead, we pick and choose and we think, well, I want this experience because that's going to be the most pleasurable. But for a Buddha, everything would be pleasurable because everything, and the pleasure would be the opportunity to respond in a creative way. For the Buddha, everything would give the Buddha that opportunity. So that would always be pleasurable, because there'd always be that chance to respond in that way. That'd be good, wouldn't it? You know, so then it's almost like you wouldn't need to fixate on this thing or that thing. It'd just be a very, very open response to the world. Whatever comes, you know, whatever there is for dinner, you just think, oh, that's great, we've got that for dinner, you know, whatever, you know, whatever encounter, you think, oh, gosh, that was great. I found a really good way to respond to that. Oh, that's, isn't that delightful? Yeah. So that's just a little bit of scratching at the surface of this topic. As I say, I really recommend that free Buddhist audio lecture. So if you look up Mind and Mental Events, 2001 Subhuti, we could listen to the whole series, but you could listen to the one on non-greed and non-hatred. This book's out of print, but as soon as it comes back into print, I thoroughly recommend it. It goes through all these mental states. If you see it in a second-hand shop or something, just nab it. That's getting a bit priceless at the moment, but it should be coming back into print. And it goes very systematically through all the things that I've been talking about and Sarah Pierre will be talking about, I'm sure. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.